What is reality? No, really, what is reality? What do we mean when we say that something is real rather than, you know, not real? What's the difference? I suppose when you tuned into this episode, you were not expecting a deep, profound, real question. I bet you weren't expecting ask a philosopher in today's episode. But when we start digging into the meaning of quantum mechanics, of which we are now an astounding 6 episodes deep, I gotta warn you, it's basically all philosophy from here on out. In the last episode, we highlighted the debates between Heisenberg and Bohr on one side and Schrodinger in the other about the reality of the wave function. Schrodinger thought it was a real thing that subatomic particles were literally smeared out over space, and others believed that it didn't have physical existence, but was merely a mathematical convenience for expressing a fundamental randomness and uncertainty of the physics of the subatomic level. That view would eventually come to dominate and be called the Copenhagen interpretation. Folks, these questions, the very first question we ask about quantum mechanics, which is the wave function real? Is matter actually wavy shaped, or does the wave function merely represent a mathematical trick for calculating probabilities? These are straight up no holds barred philosophical questions. We've moved beyond the pure physics, if there can ever be such a thing, that quantum mechanics had already established. It was a mathematical theory that could predict the outcomes of experiments. Done. Shares that with literally every other physical theory in existence. But that was it. Now we're past that. And it's important to get past that even a little because we need to learn what quantum mechanics is teaching us about the universe. Is it teaching us about reality or just our views of reality? What I left out intentionally in the last episode was a major player in these philosophical debates. Einstein. Einstein was one of the founders of quantum mechanics. Some people call him the first modern physicist. And yet, after his initial work in 1905, the spotlight of the quantum mechanical stage shifts to other actors, Schrodinger, Heisenberg, Bohr, and so on. Einstein appears here and there in the record following 1905 as more of a commentator and communicator and eventually a critic of the emerging theory rather than one of its leading lights. This is especially true in the 1930s when Einstein moves from Nazi Germany to Princeton, New Jersey. Quantum mechanics is very much a German theory of physics. Almost all the principal players were German people and thinking German thoughts. And I have to wonder if some other group of scientists at some other time and place and culture in the world, other than Germany in the 1910s and 1920s, had first encountered subatomic physics, if we would have a different theory, a different default interpretation, I honestly don't know. But it is what it is. Quantum mechanics was largely developed by Germans in the 1910s and 1920s. Einstein was one of them. And the development of quantum mechanics, especially after the foundations were laid in the mid-1920s, as it started to get fleshed out and as people started to debate the meaning and whether it was ultimately correct or if there was something deeper going on, as that continued into the 1930s, Einstein left the scene. And actually, so did a lot of people, because it's kind of hard to do fundamental physics and really much of anything as Nazism was growing in Germany at the time. But the end result was that Einstein was physically thousands of miles away from where the quantum mechanics action was taking place, which was Europe. And threading through all of this, the 1920s and the 1930s, beginning with letters, and then moving on into in-person discussions at conferences, were the famous Einstein-Bohr debates. These debates that took place between Albert Einstein and Niels Bohr. A series of debates. And I'm not going to get into the nuts and bolts of the debates. I've discussed them before. But here, the important part isn't the debate itself and what Einstein was thinking. The important part is the essence of the debates. What Einstein was doing through the 1920s and 1930s was developing thought experiment after thought experiment, and he was the unequivocal master at this, at thought experiments. He was developing these thought experiments to show that quantum mechanics was incomplete. He had a gut feeling going way back, decades back, that something was missing from Heisenberg's matrix mechanics, from Schrodinger's wave mechanics, and basically everybody's mechanics of everything. He honestly thought there were all these weird things that every time we develop something in quantum mechanics that flew in the face of classical physics, that every time we developed a new death metal song and we were able to describe what defines death metal and how it's different than classical physics, he thought that this wasn't a sign that we should extend our thinking and broaden our horizons and abandon classical thought processes. He thought it was a sign that we were missing something. Now, there's a standard story here, and it's a story that I'm even guilty of telling about these Einstein Bohr debates, these series of debates between Einstein and Niels Bohr. The standard story is that Einstein is insanely bugged by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, this apparent fact that we can't measure the position and momentum of a particle simultaneously to as high precision as we want. We can easily do that in classical physics. We can't do that in quantum physics. The standard story is that Einstein was deeply upset by this, thought it was a sign that we were missing something more fundamental, and came up with thought experiment after thought experiment to find ways around the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, to show violations of it. Because if he could show violations of it, it would prove that quantum mechanics is incomplete. In the standard telling of these debates, Einstein's arguments get almost more and more desperate as they go on. And at every turn, Niels Bohr is able to come up with a rebuttal. Einstein proposes a thought experiment and say, look, I told you Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is violated. Quantum mechanics is incomplete. And then Bohr comes in a few months later or a night later after being able to sleep and say, oh, actually, you didn't think of this angle, this particular effect, this particular part of the physics. You didn't look at the complete picture. And then Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is saved. The standard story is that these debates go back and forth. It ends up with a triumphant Niels Bohr standing on the mountain defending quantum mechanics, and then a senile old Einstein twiddling his thumbs in Princeton. Abraham Pace, one of the great biographers of Einstein, said, quote, "Einstein is the only scientist to be justly held equal to Newton. That comparison is based exclusively on what he did before 1925. In the remaining 30 years of his life, he remained active in research, but his fame would be undiminished, if not enhanced, had he gone fishing instead." Parts of this standard story are true. Einstein did spend decades believing that quantum mechanics was incomplete. Bohr is considered to have won the debates. Einstein would come up with thought experiments showing violations of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and Niels Bohr would show him to be wrong. Einstein spent decades trying to find a path out of quantum mechanics and failed. But take this story with a grain of salt, because the perspectives we have on the debates and the success of Bohr and the defense of quantum mechanics against a increasingly crazy, senile old Einstein who's, was cool back in the day, but then sold out. Those perspectives are written by Bohr. It's Niels Bohr's letters and autobiography that we get to this story. We don't have Einstein's thoughts on the subject. He didn't write a lot about his thoughts on the debates with Bohr. So if the story looks like Niels Bohr is defending successfully quantum mechanics against an Einstein that just doesn't get it, maybe there's more to the story. This standard story which, like I said, I've been guilty of perpetuating, misses a couple things. One, Einstein was a genius with a capital G, a capital E, and a capital N-yes. The whole word capitalized. I mean, come on, we're talking about the guy who established the existence of atoms, the guy who revolutionized our understanding of space and time and matter and energy, who gave us a new theory of gravity unlike anything seen before. He proposed that light itself is quantized. He kickstarted modern cosmology. I mean, come on. This is no senile, old school thinker. This is the front man of the death metal quantum revolution. He's in it. He's doing it. He led it. So if Einstein objects to your theory, you should probably pay attention. Two, this standard history that focuses on the debates between Einstein and Bohr and focuses on the Heisenberg uncertainty principle ignores Einstein's real objections to quantum physics. Those real objections were deeply philosophical and truly cut right into the middle of the nature of quantum mechanics and what it proposed to teach us about the subatomic world. His objections were about the reality of quantum mechanics. Yes, he didn't like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Yes, he didn't like the randomness and probabilities and indeterminism in quantum mechanics. And he has that famous 1926 quote that, quote, God does not play dice. But to him, those were all symptoms of a larger disease. It wasn't necessarily the uncertainty principle. It wasn't necessarily the non-determinism. It wasn't necessarily the probabilities. To him, those were all just signs. All those were symptoms of a deeper disease, which was that he believed that quantum mechanics was missing something, that we were not yet at a true theory of subatomic physics. So for example, the randomness in quantum mechanics, when he says God does not play dice, he's not saying like, I don't like quantum mechanics, I don't like randomness. He's saying that that randomness that we see in our results, in our theories, is an illusion. It's not real. It's a reflection of our ignorance of physics, not an expression of a true underlying randomness to the universe. It's not a feature of the natural world. It's not real. Einstein didn't know what was missing in quantum mechanics, and he spent decades trying to figure it out and never could. In addition to the probabilities, which he ultimately came to accept, there was one thing about quantum mechanics that he could never get over. This one aspect of quantum mechanics, to him, he would point to again and again, because to him, it stood out like a giant glowing billboard standing off the dark highway that we were all driving down on our way to Quantumville. The objection that Einstein had to quantum mechanics, this feature of quantum mechanics that he simply couldn't accept, he ended up, as decades went by, accepting the rest, but there was one he just couldn't get over. And his objections to this aspect don't get talked about much because he was right. The aspect of quantum mechanics that troubled him the most, when Einstein first started making noises about this aspect, it didn't have a name, but eventually Schrödinger would coin the term entanglement. That's what Einstein didn't like. Entanglement. What a simple word, an innocent word, even a nice word. It sounds kind of fun. But entanglement is perhaps the greatest source of angst and anxiety and hand-wringing to ever come out of quantum mechanics. And there are a lot of contenders, and we will get to the other aspects of quantum mechanics that aren't pretty. To Einstein, this was worse than the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It was worse than the probabilities and non-determinism. It was worse than anything. As the decades went by after the mid-1920s and the first formulations of quantum mechanics, people were slowly getting cool with going beyond known physics. And you're like, okay, even Einstein said, you know what? Okay, I guess we have to push past classical physics to get a handle of what's going on. There's no way around it. Experiment after experiment after experiment was just validating quantum mechanics. But entanglement was too far. What is entanglement? Well, it's entanglement. I don't know. It's this uniquely quantum thing that simply doesn't happen in the classical universe. Let me give you an example of what happens in the classical normal universe, so we can contrast it with what entanglement is. Let's say you have two particles, all right, A and B, and they interact. You know, at one time, they were far apart, and then they get close to each other. Maybe they bounce off of each other. Maybe they magnetically or electrically interact. You know, whatever. It doesn't matter. They just interact, and then they go flying off. After they've gone flying off, they're independent. They have their separate and local existences. There's this particle over here on one side of the galaxy, and that particle over there on the other side of the galaxy. Sure, 5 billion years ago, they interacted with each other, but now they're on their own. And particle A on this side of the universe or this side of the galaxy only cares about what's near that particle. And the other particle only cares about what's near that one. They don't talk to each other anymore. It's like when you break up with someone and you move to opposite coasts and you live separate lives. What your ex does has absolutely no bearing on what you do, and vice versa. You have your own friend groups. You've got your job, your hobbies, your activities, your new relationships. You couldn't care less about what your ex is doing. Sure, you had something going there for a while, but now you don't. And you don't let your ex influence you. This is how physicists viewed the world, where physics was separate and local. That after an interaction, once anything was far away from anything else, it just cared about its environment. It didn't carry a memory of that interaction. Einstein was a firm believer in these ideas of separateness and locality in physics, where what matters to you as a physical object is what's near you. Stuff far away simply doesn't influence you. He really cared about this for a few reasons. One, through his development of general relativity, he had gotten rid of Newtonian action at a distance. You know, Newtonian gravity just says one massive object instantaneously affects another massive object. Like that. The gravity of Jupiter, when it moves, immediately affects the Earth. It doesn't take time to propagate from one place to another. It's instant. Physicists had been bugged by that forever. In fact, these kinds of debates about reality versus mathematical tricks go back forever. Where Newton said, yeah, this works. Universal gravity, I got it. How it works, I don't know. I'll leave it to future generations. That future generation was Einstein, who figured out how gravity actually operates at a more fundamental level. So he had just done that. He had taken a problem where it seemed like objects on distant ends of the universe would instantaneously affect each other and turn it into a local theory of physics, that if you want to affect something gravitationally, gravitational waves have to emanate off of you and propagate at the speed of light. Like, there's a transmission mechanism. Another reason he really liked this idea of locality in physics was that he had developed special relativity, which demanded locality in all of physics via the speed of light. If I want to affect you, if I want to interact with my ex, man, I got to pick up the phone and talk. I don't just get magically interacted or affected by my ex unless I actually communicate. And lastly, Einstein argued that without locality, if physics wasn't local, you can't have a coherent theory of physics. Let's say you're running an experiment in a laboratory and you get a result. Now, if physics wasn't local, if the results of your experiment depended on what else is happening throughout the universe in some very non-local, fuzzy way, well, then when you got that result, did you get that result from the interaction you were studying inside of your experiment, or was it from some random alien fart in the Andromeda galaxy? How do you know? Without locality, you can never know exactly what is influencing the outcome of your experiments. And so physics is useless. If I can't tell what is happening in my experiment, how can I get physics done? Einstein argued that in order for something to be real, it had to be local. And Einstein realized very early on that quantum mechanics was leading to some very non-local interactions. Entanglement. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. one of the most awesome things about physics is that it's like a user manual for the universe. You can literally use it to predict the future. Now humans are a little bit more complicated. Believe it or not, people are more complicated than quantum physics. I am not joking. And life and dealing with people does not come with a user manual. And the next best thing is therapy. I have been using therapy for years. It's such a powerful tool for me to answer life's questions when those questions don't come in the form of physics problems. And I think you will benefit a lot from it too. And that's why I'm proud to have BetterHelp as a sponsor. BetterHelp is the world's largest therapy service. BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. To learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/spaceman. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/spaceman. You take two particles. They're initially separate. They each have their own individual wave functions associated with them. The cloud of probabilities, however you want to interpret it, they have their own wave function associated. Then you bring the particles together, they interact. Then they get a shared wave function. Their wave function, which is spread out over space, mingles, overlaps. And you end up with a single wave function, a single cloud of probabilities that describes both particles instantaneously. The very act of interaction mixes their quantum states in such a way that you can't separate them ever again. It's like if you broke up with your ex and you moved to opposite sides of the country, but you still follow each other on social media, you still text each other. Even though you're very far away in space, you still affect each other. Your ex gets a new romantic partner and you feel weird about it. That's affecting you. You're entangled. You get trapped in all the same arguments, all the same toxic cycles, all the same emotional ups and downs. You're not really broken up. You're just not living together anymore. You're entangled. For relationship advice, please subscribe to patreon.com/pmsider. Feel free to ask your relationship questions there, and I'll cast them in terms of physics, which is all I know. I can't guarantee it will be helpful, but it's patreon.com/pmsider. Quantum mechanics allows for entanglement, where I can bring two particles together. The classic example is quantum spin. I can bring two particles together. They become entangled. Their wave functions overlap. Now I have a single wave function that describes both particles simultaneously. Then I pull these particles very far apart. They're still entangled. And then if I flip one upside down, or I measure one and I see it's pointing up, I immediately know that the other particle is pointing down, even though I don't have to go visit that particle to find out. I know immediately. I don't have to communicate with that particle. I don't have to call. I don't have to text. I just immediately know that that particle, the state of that particle, this drove Einstein nuts. How could you know the state of something on the other side of the galaxy without receiving any signals from it? How could measurement influence things across these distances and apparently instantaneously? How could the quantum world be non-local but the classical world local? How could quantum theory be a sensible version of physics if, like, everything were connected, man? Ultimately, it appeared to Einstein that quantum mechanics was non-local. And to Einstein, this meant it was a bad theory of physics. Physics should be local. If I have a particle right in front of me, it shouldn't care what's happening to particles on the other side of the universe. It should care about what's happening right in front of its nose. That's a local theory of physics. How is non-locality supposed to work? If these questions, the focus on how quantum mechanics is supposed to, you know, work, seem similar to Schrodinger's objections to matrix mechanics, where he said, okay, there's this quantum jump. How is a quantum jump supposed to work? Here's Einstein saying, how is entanglement supposed to work? How is this non-local effect supposed to work? You won't be surprised to know that Einstein and Schrodinger exchanged a lot of letters complaining about the kids these days. To Einstein, this giant glowing billboard of entanglement signaled that we were missing something in our formulations of quantum mechanics. He believed in something that we call local hidden variables, where our version of quantum mechanics was really an expression of our ignorance of a true, real underlying physics. It didn't represent a fundamental ignorance in reality itself. Einstein believed that when two particles come close together, they exchange some information that is hidden from us. Then when we separate them, and it appears that they are affecting each other instantaneously over great distances, they're really not. Really, they just came with information that's hidden from us. And so in our current formulation of quantum mechanics, we're missing that hidden information. And so it looks like these particles are entangled with each other and influencing each other, but that's only because of an incompleteness in our theories. It's like when two particles interact, they like exchange secret notes with each other to tell each other what to do. And then they carry these secret notes folded up in their back pocket as they travel these great distances. And then when we look at the particles and we figure out their state, the result that we get isn't because there's this fundamental randomness in the universe and this particle is influenced by the state of its entangled pair partner across the galaxy. No, it's because it just opened up its secret envelope with its hidden variable information. And then once it read it, it had the instructions and it knew what to do. That's what Einstein believed, that what we see as entanglement is really a sign telling us that quantum mechanics is incomplete. This line of thinking culminated in a famous 1935 paper co-authored with Boris Podolsky and Nathan Rosen entitled, "Can Quantum Mechanical Descriptions of Physical Reality Be Considered Complete?" But it's called the EPR paper for Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen. It's called the EPR paper. Ironic, this criticism of quantum mechanics would turn out to be one of the most highly cited papers of all time. In fact, it might be the most highly cited paper of all time, including in the field of quantum mechanics itself. Now, I'm not going to get into the guts or details of the paper, just like I didn't get into the guts or details of the arguments between Einstein and Bohr. And I'm not going to do it because the paper itself was actually really poorly written. Einstein himself admitted this to Schrödinger in a letter. And the argument in the paper isn't very strong. In short, the EPR paper used a thought experiment, again, said, okay, let's take two particles, A and B. Let's entangle them. So, what does entanglement mean? It means once you separate them, if you measure the properties of one of them, you automatically know the properties of the other because they share a single quantum state. Knowledge of one entails knowledge of the other, automatically. So, okay, entangle them, then let them go fly. Measure the position of particle A. And then a little while later, measure the momentum of particle A. Two separate measurements. Now, Einstein knew from Heisenberg uncertainty principle that you couldn't make these measurements at the same time, but you could measure the position to as high precision as you want. And then a little while later, measure the momentum to as high precision as you want. And then boom, from entanglement, you know the position and momentum of particle B without ever touching it. The paper essentially said either you have to let go of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, or you have to give up locality in physics, or you need to introduce extra hidden variables to rescue everything, and that just shows that quantum mechanics is incomplete. If that argument in that paper like doesn't sound the greatest, and you're like, wait a minute, like like I said, it's not the greatest argument. It's not very well put together. Our quantum man, Niels Bohr, who seemed always ready to fight with Einstein, wrote a rebuttal paper a few months later. He submitted it to the exact same journal and took the very sassy move of using the exact same title. The title being, "Can Quantum Mechanical Description of Physical Reality Be Considered Complete?" Bohr's response was to show that the Heisenberg uncertainty principle was never violated in the example given in the paper, arguing that if you measure the position of particle A, you change what particle A is, and so you can't just follow it up with a momentum measurement and then automatically learn something about particle B. And so non-locality stands. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is preserved, and so therefore quantum mechanics is non-local. Bohr's rebuttal is considered successful, but that's only in the very limited context that the EPR paper itself was pretty lame and poorly written. Bohr's response itself wasn't very strong, in contrast to his earlier rebuttals against Einstein during those famous debates, where his rebuttals about the nature of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle were very, very strong, very coherent, very well put together. Essentially, Bohr's rebuttal is like, yeah, Einstein, you have this scenario, but it's more complicated than that, and the Heisenberg uncertainty principle isn't violated. And so, I'll repeat, non-locality stands. But Einstein's main point remained unchallenged. His main beef was that quantum mechanics was non-local. That was supposed to be the point of the EPR paper, was to demonstrate that quantum mechanics is non-local, and that's a problem. And then Bohr responded by saying, yeah, it's non-local. What's your deal? Particle A does influence particle B across the universe. Knowledge of particle A automatically gives you knowledge of particle B, regardless of how far away it is. What came out of this was that non-locality became an unargued feature of quantum mechanics, but ultimately you had to decide if you were okay with non-locality or not, and Einstein most definitely was not. Decades later, other physicists would pick up this problem of non-locality and devise ways to test the non-locality of quantum physics. I am happy to do an entire episode expanding on that. Just ask me about Bell's theorem and Bell's inequalities. The details of the test aren't important for this story. The result is that quantum mechanics is non-local. No theory that includes local hidden variables, these secret sealed envelopes that particles carry along with them to instruct them what to do, and that they have that knowledge, but we don't. In quantum mechanics, the probabilities, the uncertainty, the non-locality is an expression of our ignorance of a true underlying physics. Those theories don't survive our current tests. It seems that it's perfectly possible to know the state of an entangled quantum system regardless of distance. If I entangle two particles, send them on their merry way, I measure one, I automatically know what the other one is up to. This should make you uncomfortable. This should make you question reality. All of Einstein's objections to non-locality hold. How can you trust an experiment? Your experiment is supposed to be local. You perform your experiment, you get a result. How can you guarantee that the results of that experiment aren't influenced by entangled particles all across the universe? You can't. How does the influence of entanglement, this non-locality, actually take place? What is the mechanism? Come on, Bohr, explain it to me. How does it work? How do two particles know what the heck they're doing after they're entangled, and they can't share messages? There's no speed of light constriction, there's no signal, there's no emission, there's no hidden information. So how does it work? How does consciousness even work? How can it be possible? How can I have a pen sitting next to me. I'm going to decide to pick up that pen. How can that decision somehow appear local, where it's just me, just the pen, just the two of us? I don't need to take into account the motions of galaxies across the universe and quantum entangled interactions throughout all of space and time in order to make that decision of whether to pick up the pencil or not. This feels local. If I didn't know that the Andromeda Galaxy existed or not, it wouldn't influence my decision or my ability to pick up the pencil. Seriously, if Andromeda Galaxy blinked out of existence right now, I could still pick up that dang pencil. Was it a pen earlier? I don't remember. It's quantum mechanics, all right? The universe appears local at classical levels. Local physics is obeyed. I can guarantee the result of an experiment, and I can verify it, and it doesn't depend on the rest of the universe. Consciousness itself. How can I possibly have a thought and be able to make predictions and go about my daily life if I had to perform the calculations necessary to consider the entire universe? How would it be possible to take a single step forward if I needed to understand and account for the entire physics of the universe? No, I just need to care about the sidewalk in front of me. A molecule drifting through the atmosphere of Jupiter doesn't seem to affect me, and yet a naked reading of quantum mechanics says that everything is entangled. What gives? Einstein's objections stand. It doesn't make sense. You just get used to it. The majority of physicists just got used to the weirdness of quantum mechanics. Somehow classical physics remains unaffected. Somehow classical physics is local, and yet quantum mechanics is not local. We don't know how to connect those two dots. We don't know how to translate from the quantum world to the classical world. How does it work? Nobody knows. This is weird, and we don't have any answers. Does this mean that our knowledge of quantum mechanics is incomplete? Is what quantum mechanics teaches us about the universe real, or just a mathematical convenience for expressing our ignorance because we don't have a better idea? Einstein's objections remain. Yeah, Bohr won the debate, but he lost the war. Quantum mechanics appears to be non-local. Einstein went to his grave believing that quantum mechanics was incomplete because of this non-locality. No one could come up with an answer to Einstein. Like they say, physics advances one funeral at a time. So stay tuned for more. Thanks to everyone who have asked questions about quantum mechanics. Mihail E. on email, at Charmony on Twitter, Massimiliano S. on Facebook, Isaac P. on email, at Grubelard on Twitter, Chris F. on Facebook, Akanshka B on email, at SMTR on Twitter, Albert R on email, Julius M on email, Martin E on email, John T on Facebook, Reese C on email, Nick S on email, at Jordy R Pusench on Twitter, at Pizza Larger on Twitter, Arash A on email, HB Ariana on email, Scott M on email, Graham D on email, Martin N on email, Sample Sapiens on Twitter, Peter W on email, Mark Reap on Twitter, Sean L on email, Susan S on email, Daniel J on email, Campbell D on email, Timothy B on YouTube, Fernando G on email, and James W on email. Thank you, of course, to all my top Patreon contributors. That's patreon.com/pmsutter. Top ones this month: Justin G, Chris L, Barbara K, Duncan M, Corey D, Justin Z, Andrew F, Nalia, Scott M, Rob H, Justin Lewis M, John W, Alexis, Aaron J, Jennifer M, Gilbert M, Joshua, Bob H, John S, Thomas D, Michael R, and Simon G. You can join their illustrious ranks by going to patreon.com/pmsutter. Thank you so much, everyone. Send me questions. askaspaceman@gmail.com. askaspaceman.com. Social media @PaulMattSutter. Use the hashtag #AskASpaceman if you want to. And I'll see you next time for more complete knowledge of time and space.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first 3 audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.